Hi, everybody, and welcome to Stack Trace, the weekly podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives. And those two developers are, like always, me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. And I did consider whether I should use your proper Portuguese pronunciation there of your name, but I thought, you know, we'll stick to the way we've been doing things up until this point. I mean, we've been doing like this is the 107th episode, so I'm quite used to saying your name the way I'm saying it.
Yeah, it's our podcasting names.
Exactly. That's true.
So, John, I heard you launched something recently.
I did. I did what I promised I would do, and I launched Swift by Sundell Discover this past Friday, which actually, I must say, if I didn't pre-announce it here on the show and on Twitter that I would launch it, I probably wouldn't have made it this Friday.
That's why you need to pre-announce stuff. See?
Exactly. It gives you a deadline, right? I love that. Like when you're there in the kind of in the zone working, you're kind of cursing yourself why you put this deadline on yourself, right? Like why didn't I just not say anything and then I could have taken like another day or two. But at the same time, when you have that deadline, it kind of forces you to focus and to get that thing done and get it out of the door. And that is so valuable to me. And that's why I keep doing these things like pre-announcing when I'm confident, of course, that I will launch something like, you know, this classic 90% confident, right? That something will be done in time, because that just gives me the focus I need to like push the thing over the final finishing line.
Yeah, definitely. I find that having a deadline really helps. And I think we talked about this at length before, but yeah, I really enjoy having a prospective release date for stuff. And it really forces you in a good way to get things done. That's where I am right now with Airbuddy 2, and it's where you were with your new project. So I think, of course, setting up unrealistic deadlines is not healthy at all, and it will not work. But
of course,
when you get through like the first 80, 90% of something, to give yourself a deadline really helps so that you really focus on what's important in order for that to be shippable, and then you figure out the details later.
Yeah, that last part there is really important, because it's so easy, especially in the final parts of a project, to kind of get lost in the details, because you've been working on this thing for a while, you know, most of the time, and you have this different view of it. Like, if I don't ship it in this like perfect state with all of these different features and different kind of accessory things along with it, then it will be bad. But all the people who will use this feature have never seen it before, right? Or maybe they've heard you talk about it, but they've never used it. So they don't have the same expectations or the same perspective as you do. So I think that is so important when you are dealing with these things, to try to take a step back and to try to figure out what is the actual like minimum viable product, or, you know, product you'd be happy to ship that maybe doesn't include everything, but it includes the things that will make the feature valuable. And having a deadline really helps in that regard for me, helping that prioritization process. And that's exactly what happened on Friday. So I had all these ideas of how I wanted to integrate this new feature, which I'll tell you a little bit more about soon, into my site. And I had these ambitions, like I wanted to change the start page. I think I spoke about it on the show as well. I wanted to like create lots of integration points into the feature throughout the site and integrate it really well with search and all those kinds of things. But then I decided, you know what, that's really not important for the initial launch. The only thing I really need to launch this thing is to have the feature itself working. And then I can put that on Twitter, you know, I can share it with people, they can check it out, and then I will get feedback. And then I can improve the feature based on the feedback, and then I can start integrating it into the rest of the site. Because not everyone who reads my site follows me on Twitter, so not everyone will see this feature or even know about it, but that's okay. Like, even if just a small set of people will, you know, get to experience it on day one, that's actually even better, because it's almost like a soft launch, if you can call like promoting it to tens of thousands of people on Twitter a soft launch.
Yeah, I laughed when you told me that. I think we were messaging and you were like, oh, I'm going to do a soft launch. And then all of a sudden you had tweeted about it. And I was like, huh? Soft? What's soft about this?
Exactly. So, but it was a way to like get people to experience that feature kind of in isolation, because at that point it wasn't integrated with the rest of my site. So I want to tell you more about kind of how I built it, because I think there are some interesting aspects here in terms of kind of combining manual kind of curation, if you will, or manual work with automation. But let's just do a little recap first of what Discover is. So I mentioned a few weeks on the show that I've been kind of struggling or identifying as a problem that on my website, navigation could be a lot better and it could be easier for people to discover, hence the name, the content that I have to offer on a given topic. So when we're talking about kind of hot topics like Swift UI or unit testing or Combine or architecture or things that people are really interested in, I wanted to make it really easy for people to just see what I have to offer on that topic and to be able to then discover that and see what is there without having to like manually go through the website or find the specific link to click and so on and so forth. So I had this idea of building these like nice discover pages that enable you to like browse all of this content in a really nice way. I use this kind of philosophy that I've been using lately when it comes to web design of, it sounds pretentious, I guess, but it's kind of like magazine-like web design where I try to lay things out on the page as if it was a magazine or a newspaper. So you get this like almost like asymmetric design where the content kind of flows around different blocks and things like this. And I wanted to create something really nice where people could sit down, you know, read this page, discover what I have to offer on a given topic. So that's what Discover is these kind of very customized, editorialized category pages, really, of a specific topic. And I'm launching with Swift UI as the first topic. And I'm hoping now over the next couple of weeks to add a couple of more topics. And then, you know, as I go, I will keep adding pages as I have enough articles and enough content on a given topic to kind of create this page for it.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I really like this approach of approaching the website as like a magazine. And I think that's part of what makes your website so easy to read and so comfortable to read. Like I always look forward to reading your new post every week because the web these days, not in its best state. And sometimes you really want to read an article, but the page is just full of stuff and 50 pop-ups when you open it up and your device gets warm for some reason when you open the website. And your website is nothing like that. Fortunately, there are quite a few that I read which are like that. And I read those websites because they are like that. And yours is one of them. So yeah, I'm really happy with this approach. And yeah, I really enjoyed browsing the new Discover page on my iPad Pro, which is my device of choice for reading.
That's awesome. Glad to hear it. And yeah, the iPad Pro, I think, is a big reason also why I've really started to focus on this type of web design. Because when you open a page like that, like I'm thinking about our WWDC website that we did together, and also like these new Discover pages, when you open it up on the iPad, I mean, I don't want to say that my own work is great or something, you know, I don't want to be a critic of my own work, but I'm very happy with how it looks. Let's just leave it at that, right? I'm very, very happy with this design. And I think it looks great on the iPad Pro.
That's awesome. And how is it all implemented? I think that's what me and our listeners are really looking forward to learning about.
Sure, absolutely. I'm happy to talk about it. So doing something like this is an interesting problem where you have a bunch of content in this case. Like you have a bunch of links, you have a bunch of material, and you want to try to make sense of it as one unit. And how do you then do that? Like you could take the purely algorithmic approach and you could like generate a list based of it. You could try to do some smarts. You could even use something like machine learning maybe, or write some heuristics to kind of like put content in different parts of the page, like make it look like nice based completely on, you know, automation and heuristics. And that's an approach that I did consider. And a part of the page is built like that. So I wanted to combine that algorithmic approach with kind of manual curation, if you will, like creating the page manually also and writing more custom texts and things like that for this page. So it didn't just feel like just a normal kind of article list, like that it actually felt like something that was purpose made like this, because it really is.
Yep.
So what I did was that I used Markdown like I always do, but I created a few like extensions, if you will, to Markdown. So that's the beauty of Publish, the static site generator that I've built and that I use for the site, which is, it's just Swift code, right? Like I can write any Swift code I want in there. So what I did was that I created these like different tokens that I could put inside of the Markdown. So I could do things like dollar list, and I can say dollar grid, and then I could put like identifiers of items in there, and then my script or like the processing that I built for it would go in and find those items and actually read the title of those items, like whether it's a podcast or an article, and then automatically generate the kind of cards and generate the lists for me. So all I would have to do in my markdown is write the text that is going to be displayed on the page and then put these like tokens in to say like, here I want these articles, here I want this podcast episode, but I didn't have to like write the text for it, like write the title and description and things like that. That was all automatic for me. So I think that was like an interesting way of kind of combining the two of manually curating what's on the page, but also like using automation so I didn't have to just copy paste a bunch of links myself. And then the final thing I did, which is like, how do I make sure that these pages are kept up to date? So if I add more articles about Swift UI, how do I make sure that these get included on the Discover page? I don't want to have to remember to go back to do that manually. So what I did was then I added a metadata item for all of my items to say, if a article was published after the date when the Discover page was published, if I don't add a specific exclusion property inside of my metadata, then my publishing pipeline will actually throw an error to remind me that, hey, you should do something about that. Either you will exclude it from Discover, so I have a property called excluded from Discover, I can set that to true, and then, you know, my pipeline will not throw an error, it will just ignore that item. Otherwise, I will kind of be forced to remember to include that in the new Discover page. So I think just this whole setup like gives me a pretty nice balance between like creating something editorial manually and writing these texts myself, while also utilizing automation both to build the page itself, but also to remember to keep updating it as I add new content.
Yeah, I think that's where the beauty of this whole static website system that you've created shines. Of course, it works with other static site generators. It's not like completely new, but it's super cool that you can create these custom metadata parameters and also rules around them with your publishing pipeline so that you can completely mold publish for Swift by Sandel, and at the same time, other people can use it for whatever. Like, I think the example you give on the README is like a recipes website, so you can have like ingredients as a metadata item, and I think it's really great that it allows for this expansion, and also you can still at the same time keep this more personalized editorial aspect.
Yeah, exactly. Because running a website, quote unquote, at scale, if you will, like not in terms of people, because it's just me working on this, but in terms of number of pages and number of articles you have and things like that, really requires like a blend of doing things manually, but you also need a lot of automation because, you know, you can't remember everything manually. You can't organize everything manually. You want it to be using a certain degree of automation. So that's a balance that I'm always trying to strike, and I feel like this new feature, the implementation of it, is kind of following that mindset still as well, which is really great.
Yeah, and with these types of things, if you don't automate, at least to the extent that you have, then what will happen is you would release this page and it would sit there for months or years with no updates. So yeah, at least this way, you kind of force yourself to keep it up to date.
Exactly. Yeah, giving yourself that little reminder in the future. That's like coding in a way that your future self will thank you for is usually a good thing to keep in mind, because your future self will not remember what past self thought about. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's why I have documentation comments for my own private code, even for like pound defines, or I have documentation for all of the defaults flags in everybody, like the defaults write commands you can do to reset stuff or customize hidden settings. That's really valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So now after that little mini deep dive into my new Discover feature, I want to hear about what's going on with AirBuddy. I know that you've been doing some really cool, interesting new work there with some new features that you have in the works. So tell us all about it.
Of course. Yeah, this is not a new feature as with last week's talk about Magic Handoff.
You mean that you're not developing a new feature every week, Rambo? Come on.
Yeah, I'm really sorry for disappointing you, but it can be called a feature, kind of. It's one of the things on my like checklist before shipping, which is pretty important, which is onboarding. So I am currently working on the app's onboarding flow. And this is interesting because many people are completely against onboarding. And they're like, oh, apps should not have onboarding. It's awful. It shows that your app is hard to use or something like that. But in reality, when you have an app that's used by tens of thousands of people, there are going to be a significant number of people using the app who needs that type of handholding, let's call it that. Like, the app needs to guide you through setting it up and doing the initial configuration, and also some tips on how to use the app, especially when it's something like AirBuddy, which is, I want to call it like an invisible app. Like, it's not like
right.
You launch an app, you do something, you close it. It's like more of like a system service. So I found throughout the lifetime of AirBuddy so far that there are a class of users who don't understand how the app works. And there isn't really much I can do other than just telling them how it works right within the app, because if you look at the website, it does tell you how the app works, but many people don't read the website. They see it, they see, oh, $9.99, okay, here's my credit card, done. Download, install, run, and now what do I do? What do I do? So, yeah, so that's the purpose of onboarding. So it starts out with registration, so the whole, like, enter your license key and stuff like that, which is necessary. It then installs the actual app, which is the helper process that keeps running. And after that, I actually included a couple of little tutorial videos showing the main functions of the app. So things that I think are key to understanding how the app works, and also things that are not like very discoverable by just looking at the app. So yeah, that's what I'm working on right now, and I think it's working pretty well so far. I'm almost done with it. And these tutorials, they were inspired by the onboarding setup on iOS. So when you set up an iOS device, right after you're done with everything, it shows you a few, I think there are like 4 or 5 little tutorials, like how to go to the home screen, how to switch between apps and things like that. So I thought it would be appropriate to have something like that for everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I love that you're doing there in those videos, which also these instructional videos by Apple are doing as well, is they're showing the gesture that the user should do, and at the same time, what will happen in the app, right? Yeah. So in your video, you have like one window showing the gesture on the trackpad, for example, and what happens in the user interface or in the app at the same time when you perform those gestures. And I think that is such a great concept because it gives you this very, very strong connection, and it's very clear what I need to do in order to unlock this functionality. And around the whole onboarding versus not debate, like my take on this is that you shouldn't add onboarding as just a checkmark thing that all apps should have. Like, it's not something that's necessarily required, but having it is also not bad. So I think if you have a purpose like you have, which is to give the users like a little bit of a warm welcome, right? They just paid money, they just installed the app, they want to see what it's all about. You're showing them a couple of quick screens to show them, like, here's how you use the app, and then you're in. You can go ahead and, you know, use the app. I think that's perfect, because I think where these onboarding processes or flows go wrong is when they drag on forever. There's like a lot of different screens. You have to do a lot of things, like create an account, set a picture, upload that, do these settings and that settings. Like, that's the part that I think you should try to avoid. But if you just have a little quick warm welcome to the app, you have a few instructional videos that are easy to skip if you don't want to watch them, then I think it's perfect. I think that's a great use case for onboarding.
Yeah, I agree. I think most of the problem people have with onboarding is what you mentioned, that many apps, especially mobile apps, they use it as like spam, basically. Like, it's a bunch of screens and they kind of try to force you as much as they can to give them location permission and permission to read your contacts and things like that. And also like plug like another app from the same company or another service and set up an account, and especially what you mentioned. So I think that's where the problem comes in. And in this case, it's absolutely nothing like that. It's just going through like the motion of setting up the app. And since you have to do that, why not also add a little bit of an instructional aspect to it?
Exactly. And one key thing that you mentioned there also is that certain users will not know how to use the app. And I would also expand on that and say, not every user will immediately get all of the features, right? So that's also something you could use your onboarding for, is to kind of show some features that many people might otherwise miss. And one thing that I'm going to do in the game that I'm working on, for example, as part of the onboarding that I'm going to have for that, is to ask people or to remind them that, you know, you should turn on the sound of your phone so you can hear the sound and hear the music of the game. And it's not going to be required, right? It's not going to be like, you have to put on the sound, otherwise you can't progress. But it's just going to be a little fun reminder with some cute graphics to say, you know, we had this great music that my friend composed for the game. You might want to listen to it, because it's one of those things where, you know, I always run my phone in silent mode. I know that a lot of people do.
Yeah,
and it's just a like nice reminder to say, okay, maybe I should turn on the sound just for this game to hear what this music is, right? Because I think it will be a better experience.
Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely a good idea. And you should definitely just use that phrasing. Like, there's this nice music my friend composed. Hear it.
Exactly. There's actually even a picture of him on the onboarding screen. And when you select, like, because you can also say, I want to turn on the music or turn off the music. Like, you can just completely turn it off if you don't want to hear it, even if you have the sound on. Then there's this little chat bubble, like, you know, coming out of his head saying, now our sound composer will be sad.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So apart from the onboarding process, what else have you been working on?
So I've been having issues with WidgetKit. So WidgetKit is this new technology that's been developed for widgets on iOS 14, but it's also present on macOS Big Sur, which is currently still on beta. And the problem I have with it is, first of all, it's not working very well, but it's a beta, so that's expected, I guess, to some extent. But also that these limitations that have been put in place for WidgetKit on iOS, they don't really make much sense on the Mac. Like, most of the limitations with WidgetKit on iOS are in order to preserve battery life and processing and things like that. But when you're talking about a Mac, especially if it's like a desktop Mac, which is connected at all times, it really doesn't make sense to have like a super strict limit of what these widgets can do and what the frequency is at which they can be refreshed. So I'm a bit disappointed that I can't really provide the great experience I want with my widget on Big Sur. And the main problem is that you can, on iOS, you can keep your old widgets around if you want to, like the old style widgets, which were not done using WidgetKit. But there isn't an option like that on Big Sur. So I can't even like offer my legacy widgets on Big Sur. And I am really not happy with the experience. And yeah, I'm a bit sad, and I have filed a bunch of feedback reports to Apple, and I really, really hope that they listen, because I think most widgets in Big Sur are going to be a downgrade for people who are used to relying on widgets. I know some people were disappointed on iOS as well, but at least on iOS you have, like, first of all, you have a good reason for those limitations, which is battery life. And also, you gain so much, like, from being able to have the custom intent configurations and leave them in your home screen and things like that, where I think the compromise is worth it. But on the Mac, that's not the case, in at least in my opinion. I'm a bit sad about the state of my widget in Big Sur. And unfortunately, there isn't much that I can do to fix it other than complaining to Apple, I guess.
And what are the problems? Like, you mentioned that there are limitations there that make sense on iOS, but not on the Mac. Like, what are some of those limitations that you wish would be lifted?
Just like being able to refresh it, because you can call the little timeline refresh thingy, but it doesn't do it all the time. Like, there's I guess like a kind of a, like a budget of how much your widget can be refreshed, and then that's it, and then the system will stop refreshing your widget, or it will refresh your widget whenever you want and not when you tell it to. And with a widget that's all about showing you your batteries and the state of your batteries, like if I've just put my AirPods Pro in my ears, the widget will not show the AirPods Pro for, I don't know, like 30 minutes or something. Like, that's not good.
Right. And do you think that this might be due to like sharing code between iOS and the Mac in the implementation? And that perhaps given like everything that's going on and, you know, getting iOS 14 out of the door, that they haven't had the time yet to tweak those algorithms and tweak those kind of priority logic in order to make the most out of the Mac? Do you think it might simply be just an unimplemented thing or a bug that might be addressed before the final release?
Yeah, I think everything I'm mentioning here is just the current states on beta 9, I think, which is the one we're in right now. So it all could change before the release, but these have been a problem since early betas and I haven't seen any progress so far. There's been some activity in one or two of my feedback reports, so I hope that means they are working on it. But I do agree that it's probably caused by sharing code. It feels to me like this was one of those things where they were like, oh, let's just use the same system on macOS as well. And then like they copied and pasted the code and didn't think about it. Like, of course, this wasn't the case, but I mean, probably wasn't thought out to the extent that it should. I feel like that's the case.
Right. But we also talked about priorities and, you know, launching something and deadlines just before. And I think this might be one of those cases as well. I mean, I don't know. I don't have any insight into that, but I'm just thinking what could be the cause. And it's very common, like when you have something like this that is shipping on multiple platforms, if you know that one of the platforms is A, more important to the company, and B, shipping much earlier, you will probably focus all your attention on that first and then move on to the kind of, you know, I hate to call the Mac a secondary platform, but in this case, it might be in terms of priorities of widget kit that all of the priorities were on the iOS version. And then, you know, they just use the same logic on the Mac for now, and then hopefully they'll be able to get around to actually fixing that before release. I'm being my usual optimistic self here, right? But I hope that that's the case.
Yeah, I agree. But at the same time, if I was in charge of that, then I would simply not include WidgetKit on macOS until it's possible to make it actually work.
Right, yeah.
Because, yeah, it's pretty bad right now. Even like some basic things around configuration are not working, like Boolean properties don't work. If you have a Boolean property in your configuration intent, it doesn't show up. So that's kind of a bummer as well. There wasn't even a way to create an intent for the configuration in the early betas. I think that showed up in like beta 5 of Xcode or something. So yeah, it's not great. What bothers me the most about this is that I'm going to have to be giving support for this, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
I'm going to be getting emails and I'm definitely just going to have like a copy and paste response. Like, I'm sorry, this is an Apple issue. There's nothing I can do because, yeah, that's where I'm at right now. But it's like it's the only thing that's not really working out for me on Big Sur. The rest of the app is great. So what I will do for users who are not happy with the widget is just suggest that they use the status bar menu. Like, it's not that big a difference. Like, for the notification center, you click one button in the status bar, and for the status bar menu, you just click another button, which is the AirBuddy logo. So I don't think it's that big an issue if you really want to see the latest information of your devices.
Right. Yeah, I hope it will all work out and that you'll have happy users instead of frustrated users, and that these widget limitations will be lifted sooner rather than later. But yeah, it sounds like maybe it was shipped too early on the Mac. Maybe they should have waited until next year, like just ran it on iOS for now and then moved it to the Mac next year. But yeah, we'll see what's going to happen. But I'm crossing my fingers here for you, Rambo. I hope that everything will work out just well.
Yeah, something I am considering, and this will depend a lot on how Big Sur progresses from now on, is maybe not including the WidgetKit widget at all on Big Sur. Because then, like, I think it's better to not have it than have like this semi-working thing in there that I'm going to have to support.
Yeah, especially because of the support burden, right? Like that's a really, really big thing. Cool. But now let's start moving into our In the News segment. We also have some follow-up. That's not always we have that, but we have it this time. We also have a deep dive lineup as well. We have a lot of things we want to cover on this episode. But first, let's take a very quick break to thank this episode's first sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is brought to you by our friends at Honeybadger, the tool that combines error, uptime, and check-in monitoring for any website or web API into a single, easy-to-use platform. Go to honeybadger.io to get started for free, and when you let them know that you heard about them here on Stack Trace, then they will give you a 30% discount on your license for 6 whole months. Now, more and more teams around the world are starting to embrace the concept of DevOps by continuously integrating and deploying their code and by ensuring the highest possible uptime and quality for their user-facing APIs and services. And Honeybadger can make you a true DevOps hero by letting you monitor that any website or web API that you're working on continues to stay up, running, and working as expected. It'll send you automatic alerts in real time if an issue ever occurs, and will also give you lots of contextual information if that ever happens, so that you can then fix those issues and get your service up and running really quickly. Because we all make mistakes sometimes, and that's exactly when Honeybadger has your back. Honeybadger's included uptime and check-in monitoring also lets you know when any external services that you depend on are having issues as well. So if a background job goes missing or silently fails, or if one of your dependencies goes offline, then Honeybadger will let you know about it. And all of this gives you so much more confidence when deploying and running your software on the web, which in turn lets you deploy faster and more often without having to worry about accidentally causing your service to break and for your users to lose access to it. Head over to honeybadger.io to find out how the team behind it, Star, Josh, and Ben, created a completely bootstrapped monitoring solution that's self-funded by them, meaning that they only answer to you, the developer, their customer, rather than any venture capital firms or anything like that. And if you sign up for a free account to try it out, there's no credit card required, by the way, and you let them know that you heard about them here on Stacktrace, then they will give you a massive 30% discount on your license for 6 months. Once again, that's honeybadger.io, and remember to tell them that you heard about them here on Stacktrace, which both helps support the show and also gives you that 30% discount on your license as well. Thanks so much to Honeybadger for sponsoring this episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo. So before we move into our In the News segment, let's do some quick follow-up. So I mentioned on the last episode, I believe, and I've been talking about this for a while, about Swift's function builders feature and how I was using it to create some really interesting APIs for web development to be able to create components using a very similar syntax as Swift UI uses. And, you know, every time I've been talking about function builders, including the article that I wrote about it, I've always had to put this big caveat on it that it's not really an official Swift feature. It has this underscore in front of the keyword. I consider it the private implementation detail of Swift UI and so on and so forth. But now, finally, it has actually been fixed. Like, there is now a new proposal for function builders that are now called result builders. And it has been accepted. It has been all cleared in Swift Evolution, and it's going to be released in the next version of Swift, which will presumably be Swift 5.4, and it should be released during the spring of 2021. So it's not like we can start using them already. I mean, unless you're adventurous and you want to use this initial implementation that is there, that is not guaranteed to be an official feature just yet. But come Swift 5.4, and in a few months' time from now on, we'll all be able to use result builders and build really cool APIs using them, which I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, that's awesome. So the underscore of doom is gone.
Exactly. And I guess it will be at result builder now instead of at function builder. So I will have to do quite a lot of find and replace, but that's okay. I'm happy to do that as long as I get my official Swift feature.
Awesome.
And we'll, of course, leave a link in the show notes to the Swift forum thread where this is announced and discussed. So yeah, just wanted to do that as a little follow-up item, because like we just talked about with Big Sur widgets, like sometimes when we talk about these things, we put a lot of focus on the things that are not working or the things that we hope will be improved in the future. And although on this show, we try to keep it as positive as we can, you know, we try to be constructive about our conversations and then about our discussions. But, you know, sometimes there are things that we wish would be better. And this has been one of those things where I had been a little bit disappointed that this had been a private Swift feature for such a long time. But then I also want to take the time to actually call it out when it is fixed so that we don't only talk about things that we wish would be improved, but we also talk about when they actually get fixed and get improved. So here we are doing just that.
Awesome, yeah.
Cool. So now let's start moving into our In the News segment. And Rambo, what do you have for us this week? Or what does the world have for us this week?
The China Times has something for us this week.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. So apparently there's a new Apple silicon-powered iMac coming in early 2021. So as also known as next year, if you believe me. So yeah, this is interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And when I heard this rumor and I saw these reports, I had mixed feelings. Like, first of all, I really wanted an iMac this fall or this winter because I am definitely in the market for a new computer and I would love to have an iMac like we talked about on the show before. And hearing that it will probably be released in early 2021 instead was like, a few more months that I have to wait. But then I also saw what they were talking about that this might include and things like this. And then I got excited again that I am really looking forward to seeing what this Apple Silicon powered iMac might look like.
Yeah, so apparently this first desktop with an Apple Silicon chip is going to include the A14T chip, which is interesting. We haven't seen T yet. And its codename MT... Jade? What does MT stand for? Mountain?
Mountain, I think. Yeah, Mountain yeah. Jade.
Yeah, so the Mountain Jade processor is apparently coming with the first desktop computer equipped with an Apple Silicon chip, and it's going to be an iMac, and I think this kind of confirms what we've been talking about and other people have been discussing about the A14 being a very scalable architecture, right, where you can... Instead of like having a completely different chip for a Mac instead of an iPhone or an iPad, you can take that existing A14 and just put more in there, put more A14 in there.
Turning it up to 11 or turning it up to 15. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is probably going to be key for the strategy from Apple. This Apple Silicon strategy is for them to be able to use the same architecture and the same chip design throughout their product line. I mean, most of it at least, but then, you know, turning it up or down, for the lack of a better word, like scaling it up or down, depending on what kind of form factor it's running in. So the iPhone runs the A14, the iPad Pro might run something like the A14X, right? And the Mac might run something like A14, another letter. So it's all about like, can we add more GPU cores, activate more GPU cores maybe, or like scale up the CPU somehow? I think that's probably how they're going to achieve this like very different performance characteristics in different computers, but still using the same chip design.
Yeah, the same report also mentions that the same approach will be adopted next year with the A15, A15X, and A15T chip. So apparently, if they decide to go with this for the marketing names of the chips, we're not going to have like an M whatever chip or whatever other letter number chip for the Macs. It's going to be the same as iPad and iPhone, but instead of being X or Z or no letter, it's going to be T, which I guess could stand for turbo, maybe.
Yeah, or it's just like another letter in the alphabet that was available, right?
That's true. And also what's interesting about this is that apparently Apple is also working on their own GPU.
Yeah, that is really, really cool news. And this has been a big speculation back and forth about the Apple Silicon Macs. Like, will they use discrete GPUs that are designed by another company? Or will they actually have Apple design GPUs? And it seems like if this report is to be believed, then the GPUs will also be designed by Apple and, you know, might just be all in one system on a chip, which is, when you think about it, it might sound like that would make these new computers weaker or less capable, because typically when you have like a Mac, for example, with integrated graphics on the CPU or on the system on a chip, like the Intel integrated graphics, those are way less powerful than the discrete GPUs that some Macs also ship with. So when you have a MacBook Pro with a discrete GPU, you have way better graphics performance. But then you also can start thinking about, for example, game consoles, like the new game consoles that are coming out soon, the Xbox Series X and the PS5, they are all utilizing, or both, I should say, utilizing a single system on a chip-like architecture, similar to iPhones in a way, but in a much larger scale, of course. And then they have like these different co-processing units and things like this, but that kind of system on a chip design does not necessarily mean that this will be a slow computer. It can mean the complete opposite. It's just that everything can be integrated into one chip, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's really cool indeed. And I wouldn't be worried about, oh, that's the Mac is using the same chip as the iPhone. I think it might happen for some people who don't understand what's going on if they use the same name. But like the iPhone chip, for instance, has these low performance cores. They aren't really low performance, but lower than the high performance cores. And those are in there so that the system can schedule things to run on those processors when it's low priority, so that it doesn't spend too much CPU time and too much battery power doing things that are not that important to be done right now. And in the case of, say, a desktop Mac, maybe all cores are high-performance cores. There are no power-saving cores in there because it's a desktop.
Yeah, exactly. So they could utilize like different variants of the same design, but like, yeah, tweak it for the different products. And I think actually like having the same name could be a really big beneficial thing, because if you think about it, like, what is the most watched Apple event, for example? It's the iPhone event, right?
Yeah.
And what's the product that most people know about is the iPhone and maybe the iPad second. And those, Apple have really emphasized that they're using the power of the A14 and it's so fast and it's got these neural engine capabilities and it's got all these processors and cores and GPU capabilities. And I think that just makes it really powerful as well when it comes to the marketing of these new computers, where having it be the same chip that is in the iPhone might sound bad if you just take it out of the Apple world and you just say, here's a computer that runs a cell phone chip, right? But when you're talking about how fast these processes are and how much people enjoy using the products that use them, it could just be a benefit in terms of marketing as well.
Yeah, we haven't really seen what an A whatever chip can do when it has active cooling. I mean, the Apple TV 4K technically has a fan, but I never heard it. I think it like it's just for just to be sure that it won't catch on fire or something, or won't be throttled too much. But imagine like a Mac with the same amount of cooling they have for an Intel chip, but for an Apple chip. And then it can be pushed to its limits a little bit more than on an iPhone or an iPad.
Do we know if the A12 that they shipped as part of the developer transition kit, did that have a fan?
I think so, yeah.
So that might give us an indication, but that was also a chip that was just like taken out of the iPad and put into a Mac Mini enclosure. So it wasn't customized at all, right? Like, I don't think we can draw conclusions from that. So I do agree with you. I'm really excited to see like what the A14 can do when it's A, tweaked to fit that form factor and optimized for it, when Mac OS is fully optimized for it, and when there's also active cooling. Like, I think that combination could be really great.
Yeah, so as far as I know with the DTK, it is the exact same chip as on the iPad Pro. As far as I know as well, the like thermal profile of the chip can be customized by the firmware, so they could be doing something to that regard on the DTK, but I would say it's more likely that it's just running the same as on an iPad.
Right, exactly. So this new rumor, how does this influence your kind of potential buying decisions or idea about the Apple Silicon rollout? Like, if they now announce a laptop in the fall with Apple Silicon, will you still think about getting that? Or are you then going to wait for this iMac instead? Like, What are your thoughts now that you heard this rumor?
I will get the laptop this year, the iMac next year, and then I'll be Intel-less.
I don't even know why I asked you this question, because of course you're just going to get one of each.
Yeah, like, first of all, I have an excuse, as always, because I am a Mac developer, and the DTK is not available for the Brazilian market, so unfortunately I couldn't get that one for my testing. It doesn't seem to be that big an issue. I've had friends who totally don't have the DTK and totally didn't tell me they have the DTK and totally didn't run my app on their DTK, and it totally didn't just work perfectly. So yeah, I really would like to have an Apple Silicon Mac as soon as possible, just to have that peace of mind that like I can run every single new release of my software and make sure it works properly. Not that it's likely that it will break, but just in case.
Yeah, that sounds like a good excuse. I can't make the same excuse myself right now, so I don't know what I will do. Maybe I will still get the laptop. If it's just a laptop, maybe I will wait for the iMac. We'll have to see. It seems like there might be an Apple event on November 17th, if the rumors are to be believed. So that means we're going to have a third poker game this fall, which is going to be really exciting. And yeah, then we'll just have to wait and see, I guess. But it's always fun to speculate about these things before we've seen them. Just, you know, think about what we may or may not do and what these products might look like. That's like, at least for me, that kind of speculation is half the fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So moving on, we have one more item in the news, and that's around some additional home screen customization. Should we call them hacks? Should we call them ways or techniques that people are now customizing their home screens? So tell us, Rambo, what's going on here?
Yeah, so Launch Center Pro, this amazing productivity app and automation app for iOS, has been updated, and it now supports custom app icons through profiles, which is kind of interesting. I didn't really know that was a possibility. And this allows a user to customize the icon for an app in the home screen without resorting to the shortcuts hack, which is better because the shortcuts thing makes it so whenever you tap that custom icon, it first launches shortcuts and shortly after transitions to your app. So that's not really great. Like, it doesn't feel the same as just, oh, I changed the icon for this app. And somehow our friends over at Launch Center Pro have been able to do the same using profiles. I don't know exactly what's going on there. It's probably like some obscure feature of profiles we don't know about. But yeah, it's a lot better.
Actually, it's quite straightforward. I mean, I say that it's the same way when we joke about just implement this or just implement that, right? I'm sure the implementation was complex, but there is a feature in profiles called web clips. So The way profiles were intended to be used by Apple, for the most part, I guess, is by having different companies, like larger enterprise companies, being able to install profiles on their employees' devices and to then customize certain things. So to, for example, be able to install certain fonts that the company is using or to customize things in some other way around what apps they can install and things like this. Another key feature is putting web clips on the home screen. So for example, say you're a big company that uses some kind of web-based app for, I don't know, time reporting, and you don't have a native app for it, you just have a web app. Then you can put a link to that web page on each of your employees' home screens so they can easily access that as if it was kind of almost a native app, right? So similar to how you can take a Safari web page and put a web clip on your own home screen, like any URL you want, they can kind of pre-configure that on the enterprise level. So this is what Launch Center Pro is using to actually enable you to have custom home screen icons, where the icons you create will then be baked into a profile that you then download and install as if you were part of the Launch Center Pro Enterprise Business Corporation Worldwide Incorporated, and then you will get those icons on your home screen. So I don't know, like when I see something like this, I think it's great. I'm very happy they did it and I wish them all the best. But at the same time, like I'm wondering if this is some kind of gray zone when it comes to what's allowed on the App Store and allowed when it comes to these profiles, because it was probably not how they were intended to be used, right?
Yeah, that is true. And I think the trick there, I do know how profiles work, but I think the trick there is that they figure out a way to do it without like going through Safari first or something. Because I think by default, these web clips, they launch Safari, right? And they managed to make them run the app instead of Safari directly, like with the launch animation and everything like that.
And I think the trick there is to use the deep link into each app, right? So you put the URL of the app, like the app's own URL scheme, and that will launch the app instead of going through Safari.
They said that they are using the app's bundle ID for something. So it's not a deep link. That's what makes me confused. Like, I don't know what feature they're using. But I'll figure it out.
I'm sure you will.
So this is really cool. And yeah, I agree that with what you said about this being kind of a gray area. I think it's gonna be fine because there are already several security measures in place with regards to profiles. So when a profile is not signed with a valid developer certificate or enterprise certificate from Apple, it won't let the system respect that profile for some things. Like you can install unsigned profiles and they can do some things, but there are certain aspects of profiles that only take if the profile is signed with a valid certificate. So that's one of the things. And also, it's not like an automatic thing where like you press a button and the profile is installed and that's it. Like, no, you have to go to system preferences, go to the place where the profile is, accept the profile. Then there's like a red warning. Then you have to type in your passcode and then it's installed. So it's quite involved to an extent where if you were using it for malware, it would be very inefficient in terms of actually getting people to install it. The conversion rate for your malware would be pretty low.
Yeah, but I think if anything, this whole time now when we've had these iOS 14 widgets and people using shortcuts to customize their home screens and so on and so forth has really showed us like just the amount of steps that the average user is willing to go through in order to customize their home screen. I feel like installing a profile is not going to be an issue, right? Like that's something that I guess a lot of people are happy to do in order to get these custom icons. And I also just want to make it clear that we're not saying that David Bernard and his team and Launch Center Pro is doing anything nefarious with these. I think the opposite. I think they're only doing, you know, great stuff with it. But we're just saying in terms of like, you know, how Apple looks at this, like I think Apple has hopefully gotten a pretty big wake up call around the way people use shortcuts and the way now this app uses profiles and so on to get around the system limitations. And hopefully they will introduce some kind of system API, a proper API that both people can use to customize their icons and that apps like Launch Center Pro can use to actually do that on the user's behalf, right? So hopefully we'll see something in iOS 15 around this. But yeah, until then, we have these hacks. And it's just really fun to see just like how much work is being put into this and how much users are so enthusiastic also about customizing their iOS experience really for the first time. It feels like the floodgates have opened, Rambo. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned about the difficulty and that people are willing to go through a lot in order to get these customizations installed. And I do agree. And something I've observed in like the customization scene behavior is that it seems like the harder it is to do, the more people are proud of what they've done. Like, they're like, oh, this took me 15 hours to get right. Here's my customized home screen. It feels like the harder it is, the more proud they are.
Right. It's like a badge of honor, right? Like that you overcame this challenge and here's your reward.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I'm happy about this. And I do agree that this should probably be something built in. It's kind of like ridiculous that people have to go through all of this just in order to be able to customize app icons. It's just changing a few icons, John. Why is it so hard?
Exactly. Just change the icons.
Yeah, like on the Mac, you can just paste an image inside the info pane for a .app and it changes the app's icon. Like And the world hasn't ended because that's possible on macOS. So I feel like maybe in iOS 15, when you go to settings, you can like select an image from your photo album and use it as an icon.
Yeah, let's hope that that's going to happen. And what's fun is that if anyone would have asked me just a year or so ago, like, do I ever think that Apple will enable you to set custom home screen icons? I would probably have said no. But now when all of this has happened, it feels like there's something going on here, and hopefully we'll see a proper system support for this in future releases.
Absolutely.
But now let's move on to our deep dive segment, and we have a really fun topic lined up this week. But first, let's take another quick break to thank this episode's second sponsor. This week's episode of Stacktrace is also brought to you by Incipio. Founded all the way back in 1999, Incipio was born with a love for tech and the then quite novel idea of protecting your phone. Now, 20 years later, they're still innovating and designing cases with a complete focus on their customers. For example, their Duo case combines a minimalistic design with maximum protection. And now you get up to 12 feet, or 3.5 meters, of drop protection with their new Impact Strut technology. Also, their antimicrobial protection eliminates almost all surface bacteria and germs that won't wear or wash off. The Duo is available both for the iPhone 12 and for the iPhone 11, 10, SE, 8, and 7 series. It's wireless charging compatible and comes with a lifetime guarantee. You can find this new Duo case at Incipio.com, and using the offer code STACKTRACE at checkout gives you a special 20% discount and helps support this show. And if you're over in the US, then you can also purchase the new Duo case through Verizon at either Verizon.com or at your local Verizon store. Once again, that's Incipio.com, and the offer code is STACKTRACE to save 20% on Incipio's new Duo case for your iPhone. Thanks a lot to Incipio for sponsoring this episode of StackTrace. All right, Rambo, so it's time for our deep dive segment, and we have an interesting deep dive here on this episode, a little bit different maybe. We're not going to talk so much about deep dive in terms of technologies and APIs and things like that, but rather on kind of development practices. So there has been quite a lot of debates recently in the iOS developer community around kind of balancing computer science and correct code and using Swift language features and things like that, versus like shipping great apps and building new features for apps. And especially there's been a lot of debates around like whether Objective-C is a more pragmatic choice than Swift, or whether like really doubling down on Swift features is really productive or worth it. So I felt like, you know, this is a great opportunity for us to talk about some of these topics and how we try to balance these things and what we think about this. And it's not really in response to any particular person's opinion or something like that, but rather just a general discussion that the two of us are going to have right now. Or what do you say, Rambo?
I think that's great.
So let me start by handing it off to you and ask you, when you're doing kind of your day-to-day development work, both at the jobby job and when you're working with AirBuddy and your other projects, how do you kind of balance both writing kind of elegant, if you want to call it that, or maintainable code, correct code, versus actually shipping your apps and shipping new features to customers? How do you kind of balance the two?
Wow, that's a hard question, actually. So I am definitely more focused on getting stuff done than developing like the best abstraction or the best code or the code perfect code or something like that. I'm definitely on the camp of let's think about a user experience and write the code that makes that happen. But at the same time, I have enjoyed the benefits of having the code be as clean as possible and have abstractions where they are warranted. And I've also learned about the benefits of using things like Swift's optionals and enums and generics and all of the great features we know about the language, where they make sense. So I try to focus on getting things done that I need done, and coming back later and thinking about the problem a little more and see if I can improve the implementation, not just for the sake of improving the implementation, just so that I look at the code and I feel better about myself, but actually, like, what could I do here that would make this easier to change later, or that it would, or maybe I notice that I'm doing the same thing a little bit differently in three different places, and it could be abstracted to like a single thing that does all of them. This is something you have to be careful about. Like, not all duplication is bad. That's why I mentioned, like, oh, I've done this in five different places and it's pretty much the same. That's when I started looking at doing it in a more reusable fashion. But I usually start out fairly rough and refine the solution as time goes on. And especially when I need that refinement, not just because I want it to be better for the sake of being better. And I also don't focus on like using as many language features as possible. Like, an instance is generics. I've been working in AirBuddy a lot, so I have the code base fresh on my mind. So I think there's like one place that uses generics, and it's because it's like an extension on a collection or something. So like, generics is something that I didn't really have to use, so I just didn't use it. Could I find places where I could use generics in there? Probably. Will I? Probably not. So yeah, I think it's in my case, it's a matter of doing what has to be done as quickly as possible without like using try exclamation mark and force unwrapping everywhere. And then when I notice that I could benefit from using some other language feature or improving the code somewhat, I then do it.
Yeah, I really agree with that approach. I think that when we look at language features, the goal should not be to use as many language features as possible, right? That feels like a non-goal, right? It's not about showing off just how well you know Swift or, you know, how cool this thing can be done in Swift. Like, that's not really the point. It can be fun to do these things occasionally and in certain environments. Like, for example, when I am working on some of my own projects, I do more of that kind of stuff because it's also part of my job, right? Like, part of my job is writing about Swift, explaining new things about Swift, and keeping track of the evolution of it. So, of course, I need to also think about these things and try them out and experiment with these things. But that doesn't mean that I do that for every single project that I work on. Like, for example, when I work for clients, I do almost none of that because I don't want to bill my clients for time spent on playing around with Swift features, right? Like, that doesn't feel fair. Yeah. So I do that in my own projects, right? And then I can apply a lot of those learnings in the client projects as well and in different kinds of projects, but it's the exploration part kind of that I'm wearing a different kind of glasses, if you will, when I'm working with my own projects versus other client projects and other projects where, you know, depending on the situation, I might focus more on the code itself and the different features it uses and less on that in other contexts. But in general, I completely agree with you. I think that when we're building apps and when we're working on code, like, the language features are there to help us accomplish certain tasks or to make things easier to reason about or to make them easier to implement. It shouldn't be the other way around. We shouldn't be using language features for the sake of it or make our code harder because we wanted to use a certain language feature. Like, that for me doesn't make much sense. And I feel like that's kind of an anti-pattern. And it's related also. I feel like the same thing is true when we're talking about these more kind of very strict, rigid architectures that some people really like, where it's like it really has some really strong opinions around, you know, what kind of classes and objects you should have for each feature in your app. I feel like it's kind of a little bit the same thing there, is that we're focusing then too much on the architecture itself rather than on what we're actually building. I think it's the same thing there where what we're building should then inform the architecture. We should try to use the architecture in a way that lets us build something really robust and maintainable. It's a great product, but it's also easy to maintain the code. And so I have the same opinion there of both the language features and architecture and all kinds of tools we have at our disposal as developers. Unit testing is another one of those examples where you could say, let me just do TDD completely, you know, super hardcore. Everything should be 100% unit testing coverage. But if you just focus on the test, I mean, that's great. For certain projects, that might be the way to go. But for most kind of apps that you might work on, having those kind of very strong mindsets of like, I want to use all the Swift language features. I only want to have 100% test coverage and I want to use this super strict architecture. That will probably slow you down because then I feel like you're a little bit losing focus on what you're actually trying to achieve, which is building a great product. So I feel like that needs to come first. And then the tools should enable us to achieve our goal, not be an obstacle to achieving our goal.
Yeah, definitely. I think what we mentioned there about the architectures is very similar to what I talk about in my many view controllers talk from .Swift. Where people see like these conference talks and articles and things like that about architecture X, and the people who are presenting this architecture, which is usually, like you mentioned, super strict and full of little details that you need to follow, they're usually people who work for big companies with like 100 iOS developers or something. And they are basically solving a problem that they've created for themselves.
Right.
And when you try to apply that for your one person app or your 3 to 5 person app, it doesn't really work because that's been developed to scale and to work for the workflow of that huge team. And if you try to just move that into your work as a single developer or as a small team, it won't work as well, or it won't work at all, and it will just slow you down. That's not to say like that these architectures are bad or that they don't work for the companies using them, but that's something very specific to a very narrow space in the market, which is these companies with hundreds of developers for the platform, and it's probably not going to be your case.
Exactly, because I think one thing you're getting at here, and that is kind of the key of all of this to me, is context. That's your favorite word, right,
yep.
Rambo? You love when programming symbols and APIs have the word context in them. But context really is key here, because what makes sense in one context or for one project might not make sense for another one. So it's very hard to draw these like very strict rules here, or to say, you know, you should only focus on the computer science aspects or you should not focus on them at all. In fact, you probably need to be on a spectrum between the two, right? So focus too much on the language features or too much on the kind of algorithmic side or making everything run as absolutely efficient as possible is probably not worth the time. But at the same time, if you completely ignore those things and you say, let me just make things work, well, they might work initially, but then you might have a huge problem later where the code becomes unmaintainable or hard to reason about. Or we talked about earlier in this episode how your future self might not understand anything that your past self was trying to do because you just made it in such a rush without any kind of thoughts about maintainability and things like that. So I think it really needs to be a balance, and the balance, like where you're going to strike that balance, it all depends on the context. So if you're working in a company with 20 developers or 100 developers or more, you're going to have a different context than if you're working on your own or if you're just working with a few people. And then your decisions is going to need to be strongly influenced by that context. But regardless, I still think that you need to be somewhere on that scale instead of going, you know, to one extreme of those two camps of saying, you know, I'm going to completely ignore everything that has to do with computer science, or I'm going to only focus on that. I think neither of those extremes is very productive.
Yeah, and I think your motivation behind it also has an effect. Like, I am completely not focused on the computer science aspects of anything that I'm doing. But when I need to, in order to enable an experience that I want to develop, then I'm all in on the computer science, right? So if I need something and I need like this algorithm or to learn about whatever Bluetooth packet stuff I need to learn, then I'm all in. And also, I think a lot of this discussion boils down to people want other people to be exactly like them. And
right,
this is not productive either. Like, there might be people who don't care about the user experience at all, but they're great programmers and they work on some like core nitty-gritty database optimization stuff that's really important and ends up enabling a great user experience. But they themselves don't really worry about that direct impact they have because they are so focused on that really narrow problem within computer science. And I think that's fine as well. Like, I think it's good to have a diversity of mindsets in this case.
Yeah, I totally agree. And especially when you're working on a larger team, you really want that diversity. You say you want diversity in all aspects, right? Like in terms of what kind of people they are, where they're from, you know, everything, but also in terms of skill set as well and preference. So like you mentioned, like the person writing that really low level database code and being super focused on like all of the like time complexity of all the APIs and making everything super efficient, that will eventually help like the people working on the animations and the UI layer, because the amount of processing power that will be needed to run all those database optimizations will just make more room for really cool animations that are going to be really fluid and have a great user experience. So when we're building these things, we also have to remember that regardless if we're working on our own or with other people, that it's like a whole that needs to come together, and it's an app has so many different parts, and we might need to focus on different aspects in different layers. Like when I'm building the UI layer of an app, I might be more in a mindset of throwing something together to make it look the way I want and then refactoring it. And maybe, you know, for a certain release, I might not have time to do that refactoring. So I kind of take note of it as some tech debt that I want to clean up for the next release. But the UI still looks great. It still feels great. But then the under the hood implementation, like the actual like APIs that I'm using and my data management and stuff, is really robust, well-tested. And I spent a lot of time on it, making sure it's really maintainable code. I think that's fine too. Like having these different trade-offs on different levels of the application or during different times of its life cycle. Maybe in the beginning, before you've validated your approach or your product, maybe you don't want to spend too much time on building the perfect code base. Maybe you want to move a little bit faster, and then you can, you know, clean things up as you go. So I think it's all about like, again, it's about the context, but it's also about like trying to be pragmatic about the decisions without going to, you know, an extreme of saying like, I'm never going to focus on this, or I'm only going to focus on this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So speaking of focus, that's what we want to dive a little bit deeper into next, around the focus of the iOS community right now and how that maybe has evolved or changed over time. But before we do, let's take a final break and thank this episode's third and final sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is also brought to you by Totally, which offer ultra-thin, minimalistic cases for your iPhone. Since their cases are super thin, they're also MagSafe compatible. So if you have an iPhone 12 or 12 Pro, then Totally might have just the right case for you. Totally's cases are completely unbranded as well, and made for people who don't actually like having a case at all, but who still want some extra protection for their phone. Their goal is to keep your phone looking the way it was designed to look, even when you're using a case. And their cases are now available for all models of the brand new iPhone 12 series. Plus, all Totally products come with a 2-year warranty, so if your case cracks, they'll send you a new replacement, no questions asked. Head over to totallycase.com, that's TOTALLEECACE.com, and use the offer code PODCAST to get a 25% discount on your case. Once again, that's totallycase.com, and the offer code is PODCAST to save 25% off one of Totally's iPhone cases. Thanks a lot to Totally for sponsoring this episode of Stack Trace. All right, Rambo. So now let's talk about the focus of the community, because every once in a while I see this opinion in different articles or on Twitter and things like this, people talking about the focus of the community and how it has shifted from being iOS focused to now being more focused around Swift as a language. So when we talk about different Swift features and, you know, using Swift and things like that, rather than talking as much about iOS app development specifically and, you know, building UIs and things like that. So the first thing I want to ask you on this is, do you share this view, like this opinion, or what do you think is going on here?
Yeah, so I don't disagree completely with this notion that there seems to have been more Swift-focused content in the past few years, I would say, since Swift was introduced, than the years before, of course, because Swift didn't exist. But in terms of like, it looks like people stopped writing about making UI or creating this cool transition, or how did I make this really cool app that sold millions in the App Store and started talking about Swift features. And I said stopped, but I don't agree with the notion that people have stopped completely writing about other stuff. But I think we dabbled on this in a previous episode, and I think I am still of the same opinion that it's not that Swift was the cause of this change or that different people became involved and caused this change in focus. I think what caused this change was the new shiny. So Swift was new. It's not that new anymore, but it's still a lot more recent than Objective-C or even iOS app development. So I feel like people tend to focus more on what's new. That's why even more recently you've seen so much content being produced about Swift UI and not a lot about how I wrote this app in Objective-C, because it's not as cool to write about Objective-C because it's not new. So I think it's like a natural thing that happens when there are new things. People start writing more and talking more about the new things and less about the old things. And I don't think that's necessarily wrong. And also, if you feel so badly about there not being new content of the area you like to see, maybe you should be the change you want in the world and make that content. And that's in part what I do, because I talk like in my architecture talk how I was kind of tired of reading blog posts about app architecture, so I decided to make, and also tired of people asking me about app architecture, so I decided to make like a canonical talk about my opinions on app architecture just so I could get over it. And in my blog, I tend to write more about app development related stuff, not directly related to any particular language. But what's your take?
So I think the coolness factor that you mentioned there is definitely a thing, and different trends come and go, right? So, you know, right now we might be very focused around these new frameworks from Apple, like Combine and Swift UI and widgets and things like that, that people want to learn how to build and how to use. So that's kind of a trend right now. And then we might see a different trend next year or, you know, in a couple of months and things like that. But I also think it has a lot to do around what people want to learn, or rather what isn't clear, or what there's demand for more material around. So if we, for example, take the year 2014 when Swift was announced, it was pretty clear from the beginning that this was a direction Apple was going to head in, that they were heavily invested in this language, that they wanted to convert, you know, all their APIs and everything to this new language. They wanted the whole community to adopt it and move to this new language. So that created a huge demand for Swift material, right? Because Objective-C as a language was already very well documented, and you know, there was already a lot of material around it. There was a lot of material around UIKit and things like that. So that wasn't really lacking. But what was lacking was Swift material, right? So there was some from Apple, but there wasn't a lot. And that created a huge demand where a lot of people started stepping in. And I wasn't part of that initial kind of phase, because back then I wasn't doing any writing or anything like this. I started in 2017, so 3 years later. But I saw a lot of people getting in there and, you know, starting to write and talk about it, creating videos and things like that to kind of fulfill that demand, right? Because that was the new thing that people didn't know, and they wanted to learn this new language and they needed material to learn it. So that is kind of another natural thing that happens when there's something new. You know, different people step up to share their learnings, to create material for other people, to also see it as an opportunity maybe to start blogging or starting a YouTube channel or whatever it might be. So that is something that happens. And it's happening again with Swift UI, and it will keep happening. Like every time there's a demand for material, there will be probably people who want to help out and fill that void, right? But a second thing for me, at least, so I can only speak for my personal take here, because I am one of these people who write a lot about Swift. So why is my website called Swift by Sundell and not called iOS by Sundell? Well, it wasn't so much that I didn't want to write about iOS things, because if you actually go through my articles and look at what I'm writing about, a lot of it is pretty iOS-centric, and I write about a lot of things that has to do with iOS. So it's not that I don't want to write about these topics. It's more about how do I phrase the website as a whole? So I could have called it iOS by Sundell, but then it would have been limited to just iOS. And I didn't want that. I wanted it to be a little bit broader. So I wanted it to also cover things like macOS or server-side development or static site generation now. Things, other parts of development that I'm interested in.
And it's great that you had that opportunity because, for instance, the website where our podcast is published is called 9to5 Mac and not 9to5 Apple.
Right.
Because back then when the site was founded, there was just Mac.
Exactly. And if I would have founded the site a couple of years earlier, it just might have been called iOS by Sundell, right? Because that's maybe everything I was focused on back then.
Yeah, and one of the great sources about Swift on the market is objc.io.
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's a very funny thing. It also goes to say, like, when you have a strong established brand, you probably don't want to change it, right?
Exactly.
Like 9to5 Mac, Objective-C.io, and so on and so forth. So I chose Swift by Sundell because I felt that was the kind of common denominator around all the things I wanted to write about and talk about and eventually do podcasting about. So it's not so much that it's only about Swift as a language. It's just that Swift is what I'm using to communicate my ideas to the audience, right? So if you say that, oh, my website is just about Swift as a language, that's kind of not the whole story, I feel like. So that's another part that you might see Swift as a kind of a unifying factor when you want to talk about iOS, Mac, other Apple platforms, now server-side development and other areas of programming. Swift is kind of a, you know, broadening of the scope, if you will. And then the final thing is how easy it is to communicate code in a language like Objective-C, for example, versus Swift. And I can tell you a story of, I actually once was running the exact same workshop twice, but once in Objective-C and once in Swift.
Mm.
And I can tell you that just this direct comparison, so this was a couple of years ago, back when there was way more companies still, you know, using Objective-C as their primary language. So I did one workshop for one client in Objective-C, and then with the exact same setup or content, but instead just translated into Swift. And I can tell you that the Swift workshop was perhaps an order of magnitude easier to run. And this is not a, you know, a criticism against Objective-C as a language, but it's just like one core goal of Swift was to make the code more concise. And when you're communicating your code through an article or through a workshop or something else, having something that is more concise is definitely an advantage. And, you know, I'm not going now into like language features. I'm just talking about how it looks like on the page, right? Like how the code looks like.
Yeah, try to write a model with a value type semantics in Objective-C. You can do that in like 5 lines of code with Swift with like 4 properties. In Objective-C, you have like to implement the NS copying protocol and things like that. It's definitely not as concise. Like, and I also love Objective-C still. I still write it every now and then and I have no problem with it, but I feel like Swift has made me a little bit more productive after all.
Right. And again, I'm not even going now into like the productivity aspect or, you know, the language features and things like that. I'm just talking about the syntax, how it looks like on the page, right? And I don't think like there's any denying saying that Swift is more concise in terms of syntax, because it is, right? So I think that's a third reason why a lot of websites use Swift as a language compared to Objective-C, especially in the beginning as well, because it was so much easier to communicate ideas using it. So that's a long about way to saying why I think, you know, the community's focus has shifted more towards Swift. It's not perhaps so much that everyone is just talking about Swift language features and everybody in the community is just thinking about the programming language. It's just like what kind of unifies the community in a way, whether you're working on macOS or on iOS or something else, you know, we're all, most of us at least, using Swift. So I think that's a big part of the story.
I love how you almost said that the community focus has swifted.
Exactly. So yeah, I think that's kind of wraps up at least my opinions on this whole debate or this topic. I think that sometimes we need to focus on the language features, because especially when we're talking about APIs from Apple like Swift UI and Combine, they are making heavy use of like really advanced generics and using a lot of Swift language features to like their fullest extent. So in a way, using those kind of force us to learn more about Swift as a language and explore it more in order to make the best use of those new APIs from Apple and to build great apps. So that's kind of another thing that's happening. But I don't necessarily think that we are too focused on language features. I think it's great to learn them, but I also think that it's important to not lose sight of our objective, which is to build great products, and the language features should just be there to help us do that.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Cool. So that was a deep dive, if I ever saw one. That was a really deep dive into this topic. So that was really fun. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, feel free to tell us about it or give us any feedback that you want. We actually have a new email address for the show, don't we, Rambo?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's really cool, right? We're going back to the old days. But all kidding aside, we know that some people prefer to reach out privately, and Twitter, not everyone has a Twitter account. We do, but that's not the case for all listeners. So we do have an email if you want to send us feedback privately over email. It's stacktrace@9to5mac.com.
There you go. And we would love to get your email. So please send us any feedback you have. If you have some follow-up, if you want to ask us questions, you can send it there. You can also, of course, tweet your questions with the hashtag AskStackTrace, and we'll see it there as well. So whichever method you prefer to contact us, we would be happy to hear from you. And the first person who has asked us a question for this week is Davut. And Davut wants to hear what our opinion is on dependency injection for iOS apps. Is it recommended for every project? And how do we normally implement it? Do we use some kind of framework, or do we just manually write our dependency injection code? So Rambo, how do you typically use dependency injection?
So my approach to dependency injection is very much the basics of dependency injection, which is passing parameters to things. I will have like initializers for things, and they will take dependencies in as parameters. I've done in the past like have like an environment object, not to be confused with Swift UI's environment object, but have like a container for lots of dependencies if something has a lot of dependencies. And many times these dependencies might actually be like singletons, and they will just be have a default of like dot shared or something. But I still do dependency injection because I can then customize that whenever I need to for whatever reason, whether it's for like a test, an automated test, or if I'm doing some manual test and I want to replace something with a mock for some reason. I always like to have that override point easily available whenever I am working in my app. So yeah, I do think it's a good thing to do dependency injection. And I don't think you need any type of special library or something to do it. I know there are some fancy ways to do it, but in all of my projects, it's just passing parameters to things.
Yeah, I am the same way. I don't use any kind of dependency injection frameworks. And it also goes to kind of what we were talking about earlier around, I don't want to focus too much on the tool that I'm using to do it, but rather just like doing it as a way to improve my overall code and improve the maintainability of my code as well. So I do the same thing. Like, I feel like when we talk about dependency injection, it can sound like this really complicated thing, right? Like dependency injection sounds kind of scary, right? Like an injection is not something most people think is a fun thing. So, you know, it can sound really complex, but it's really just what you said. It's passing objects to other objects. It's that instead of an object having its own dependencies that it manages itself, like it either creates them itself or it accesses them directly through something like a singleton, it gets them passed in as part of its initializer or as part of like a parameter or something like that. And that's really just all there is to it. So if you have two objects, let's say you have a image loader and you have an image cache, instead of having the image loader create the cache itself or use something like image cache.shared, it gets a cache injected in the initializer and it can use it. And the benefit of that is that you can modify the cache depending on different situations without having to change the image loader code as well. So you can separate concerns. And you can also do what you mentioned, Rambo, like during different testing situations, you can mock the cache or create a separate cache for testing and control your object that way. So it's really, really useful. And it also creates, I feel like, a better code structure where if I have injected dependencies in the top of my class or in my struct, I kind of know what dependencies this type is using, so it becomes easier to understand the implementation. But I don't think we need to make something really complex out of it. I think we can just leave it at that. It can just be objects being passed to other objects as part of the initializer or parameters or properties, and that's it, right?
Yeah.
So, and one little twist on this that I like to use sometimes, and this is something I wrote about as well, so we'll put a link in the show notes, but I also sometimes just like to abstract my dependencies as functions. So if I have something that a certain class needs to use, but it just needs to call one function on that object, for example, let's say I have some kind of loader that has a load method that returns like a publisher of a certain model, I can just inject a function that gives me that publisher without having to inject the object or create a protocol or something like this. And this, I feel, just really simplifies the dependency injection process because I just don't need to create like a lot of abstractions to do it. And also in my tests, I can just replace that dependency with a closure. And that, I feel like, is really nice and lets me create tests really quickly without having to introduce a whole lot of kind of boilerplate or, you know, architecture around it. It becomes really simple. So that's another thing I would recommend at least learning about and checking out. It's not something that I use all the time, but it's an interesting technique to use here and there.
Oh, nice. That's a really cool tip.
Nice. So that's the end of this episode of Stack Trace, our extra long spectacular about lots of different topics. So again, we hope you enjoyed it. Feel free to reach out if you have any feedback. Feel free to leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts if you enjoy our show. That's always really appreciated. Feel free to check out one of our sponsors if you want to help support us financially, because just checking out a sponsor using the URLs that we read out and that is in the show notes, that really helps support us financially and helps keep the show going. So please do that. And just to thank our sponsors once more, thanks a lot to Incipio, Totally, and Honey Badger for making this episode possible. But of course, always thank you the most, our wonderful listeners, for listening to our show. And we'll talk to you again next week. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.